File 17.
When the first signs of a new revolutionary epoch appeared in Europe, they gradually scattered the fire throughout Austria. And when the fire began to glow steadily, it was fed and fanned not by the social or political conditions, but by forces that had their origin in the nationalist yearnings of the various ethnic groups. The European revolutionary movement of 1848 primarily took the form of a class conflict in almost every other country, but in Austria it took the form of a new racial struggle. Insofar as the German-Austrian there forgot the origins of the movement, or perhaps had failed to recognize them at the start, and consequently took part in the revolutionary uprising, they sealed their own fate. For they thus helped to awaken the spirit of Western democracy, which, within a short while, shattered the foundations of their own existence. The setting up of a representative parliamentary body, without insisting on the preliminary that only one language should be used in all public intercourse under the state, was the first great blow to the predominance of the German element in the dual monarchy. From that moment, the state was also doomed to collapse sooner or later. All that followed was nothing but the historical liquidation of an empire. To watch that process of progressive disintegration was a tragic and at the same time an instructive experience. The execution of history's decree was carried out in thousands of details. The fact that great numbers of people went about blindfolded amidst the manifest signs of dissolution only proves that the gods had decreed the destruction of Austria. I do not wish to dwell on details, because that would lie outside the scope of this book. I want to treat in detail only those events which are typical among the causes that lead to the decline of nations and states, and which are therefore of importance to our present age. Moreover, the study of these events helped to furnish the basis of my own political outlook. Among the institutions which most clearly manifested unmistakable signs of decay, even to the weak-sighted Philistine, was that which, of all the institutions of state, ought to have been the most firmly founded. I mean the Parliament, or the Reichsrat, Imperial Council, as it was called in Austria. The pattern for this corporate body was obviously that which existed in England, the land of classic democracy. The whole of that excellent organization was bodily transferred to Austria with as little alteration as possible. As the Austrian counterpart to the British two-chamber system, a Chamber of Deputies and a House of Lords, the Herrenhaus, were established in Vienna. The houses themselves, considered as buildings, were somewhat different. When Barry built his palaces, or, as we say, the Houses of Parliament, on the shore of the Thames, he could look to the history of the British Empire for the inspiration of his work. In that history he found sufficient material to fill and decorate the 1,200 niches, brackets, and pillars of his magnificent edifice. His statues and paintings made the House of Lords and the House of Commons temples dedicated to the glory of the nation. There it was that Vienna encountered the first difficulty. When Hansen, the Danish architect, had completed the last gable of the marble palace, in which the new body of popular representatives was to be housed, he had to turn to the ancient classical world for subjects to fill out the decoration plan. This theatrical shrine of Western democracy was adorned with the statues and portraits of Greek and Roman statesmen and philosophers. As if it were meant for a symbol of irony, the horses of the quadriga that surmounts the two houses are pulling apart from one another towards all four quarters of the globe. There could be no better symbol for the kind of activity going on within the walls of that same building. The nationalities were opposed to any kind of glorification of Austrian history in the decoration of this building, insisting that such would constitute an offence to them and a provocation. Much the same happened in Germany, where the Reichstag, built by Wallo, was not dedicated to the German people until the cannons were thundering in the World War, and then it was dedicated by an inscription. I was not yet 20 years of age when I first entered the palace on the Franzensring to watch and listen to the Chamber of Deputies. That first experience aroused in me a profound feeling of repugnance. I had always hated the Parliament, but not as an institution in itself, quite the contrary. As one who cherished ideals of political freedom, I could not even imagine any other form of government. In the light of my attitude towards the House of Habsburg, I should then have considered it a crime against liberty and reason to think of any kind of dictatorship as a possible form of government. A certain admiration which I had for the British Parliament contributed towards the formation of this opinion. I became imbued with that feeling of admiration almost without my being conscious of the effect of it, through so much reading of newspapers while I was yet quite young. I could not discard that admiration all in a moment. The dignified way in which the British House of Commons fulfilled its function impressed me greatly, thanks largely to the glowing terms in which the Austrian press reported these events. I used to ask myself whether there could be any nobler form of government than self-government by the people. But these considerations furnished the very motives of my hostility to the Austrian Parliament. The form in which parliamentary government was here represented seemed unworthy of its great prototype. The following considerations also influenced my attitude. The fate of the German element in the Austrian state depended on its position in Parliament. Up to the time that universal suffrage by secret ballot was introduced, the German representatives had a majority in the Parliament, though that majority was not a very substantial one. The situation gave cause for anxiety, because the social democratic faction of the German element could not be relied upon when national questions were at stake. In matters that were of critical concern for the German element, the social democrats always took up an anti-German stand, because they were afraid of losing their followers among the other national groups. Already at that time, before the introduction of universal suffrage, the Social Democratic Party could no longer be considered as a German party. The introduction of universal suffrage put an end even to the purely numerical predominance of the German element. The way was now clear for the future de-Germanization of the Austrian state. The national instinct of self-preservation made it impossible for me to welcome a representative system in which the German element was not really represented as such, but always betrayed by the social democratic faction. Yet all these, and many others, were defects which could not be attributed to the parliamentary system as such, but rather to the Austrian state in particular. I still believed that if the German majority could be restored in the representative body, there would be no occasion to oppose such a system as long as the old Austrian state continued to exist. Such was my general attitude at the time when I first entered those sacred and contentious halls. For me, they were sacred only because of the radiant beauty of that majestic edifice, a Greek wonder on German soil. But I soon became enraged by the hideous spectacle that met my eyes. Several hundred representatives were there to discuss a problem of great economical importance, and each representative had the right to have his say. That experience of a day was enough to supply me with food for thought during several weeks afterwards. The intellectual level of the debate was quite low. Sometimes the debaters did not make themselves intelligible at all. Several of those present did not speak German, but only their Slav vernaculars or dialects. Thus I had the opportunity of hearing with my own ears what I had been hitherto acquainted with only through reading the newspapers. A turbulent mass of people, all gesticulating and bawling against one another, with a pathetic old man shaking his bell and making frantic efforts to call the House to a sense of its dignity by friendly appeals, exhortations, and grave warnings. I could not refrain from laughing. Several weeks later, I paid a second visit. This time, the House presented an entirely different picture, so much so that one could hardly recognize it as the same place. The hall was practically empty. They were sleeping in the other rooms below. Only a few deputies were in their places, yawning in each other's faces. One was speechifying. A deputy speaker was in the chair. When he looked round, it was quite plain that he felt bored. Then I began to reflect seriously on the whole thing. I went to the Parliament whenever I had any time to spare, and watched the spectacle silently but attentively. I listened to the debates as far as they could be understood, and I studied the more or less intelligent features of those elect representatives of the various nationalities which composed that motley state. Gradually, I formed my own ideas about what I saw. A year of such quiet observation was sufficient to transform or completely destroy my former convictions as to the character of this parliamentary institution. I no longer opposed merely the perverted form which the principle of parliamentary representation had assumed in Austria. No, it had become impossible for me to accept the system in itself. Up to that time, I had believed that the disastrous deficiencies of the Austrian Parliament were due to the lack of a German majority. But now I recognized that the institution itself was wrong in its very essence and form. A number of problems presented themselves before my mind. I studied more closely the democratic principle of decision by the majority vote, and I scrutinized no less carefully the intellectual and moral worth of the gentlemen who, as the chosen representatives of the nation, were entrusted with the task of making this institution function. Thus it happened that, at one and the same time, I came to know the institution itself, and those of whom it was composed. And it was thus that, within the course of a few years, I came to form a clear and vivid picture of the average type of that most lightly worshipped phenomenon of our time, the parliamentary deputy. The picture of him, which I then formed, became deeply engraved on my mind, and I have never altered it since, at least as far as essentials go. Once again, these object lessons taken from real life saved me from getting firmly entangled by a theory which, at first sight, seems so alluring to many people, though that theory itself is a symptom of human decadence. Democracy, as practiced in Western Europe today, is the forerunner of Marxism. In fact, the latter would not be conceivable without the former. Democracy is the breeding ground in which the bacilli of the Marxist world pest can grow and spread. By the introduction of parliamentarianism, democracy produced an abortion of filth and fire, the creative fire of which, however, seems to have died out.